True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
When he was 19, Chuck Riley met 15-year-old Marlene Olive while he was dealing drugs at her high school. He developed a crush on her, and they eventually became boyfriend and girlfriend. Marlene controlled their relationship, and Chuck would do anything to please her. Marlene had a deeply troubled home life. Her mother, Naomi, suffered from alcoholism and mental illness. Marlene and Naomi fought constantly. Marlene rebelled at an early age with heavy drug use, delinquency, self-harming behaviors, shoplifting, and promiscuity. As the mother-daughter relationship imploded, Marlene sought out Chuck's help to kill Naomi. When Marlene's parents stood together to rein in Marlene's behavior, her father was added to her hit list. Join us at the quiet end today for California Parricide, the story of a vicious double murder, which many people should have seen coming, but no one ever imagined would really happen. And what do we have for a beer today, Dick?
We have a very nice beer called Pugachev Royale from Hangar 24 Brewing Company. Now, this is a big boy. I'm reverting back to my roots. It's a Russian Imperial Stout, and it's almost 15% alcohol by volume.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. We'll be sharing.
Okay.
So it's black. There's really no head at all to the beer. It's got a barrel aroma, kind of oaky, a lot of booze, fair amount of chocolate. Then when you get down to the taste, mostly brandy, a little bit of bourbon in the background, kind of a chocolate fudge.
Yummy.
And some maple syrup. Oh, it's a wonderful, wonderful tasting beer.
Does it really taste good even with all that booze?
It does.
Okay.
I mean, and even with that, I mean, when you think about it, the booze does make it a little hot. When you're drinking, but geez, it's a great beer. So we'll share.
Okay, sounds good. Let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, let's go down to the quiet end. It smells delicious. I can't wait to try it.
You're going to like it.
Yeah.
Busy down at the quiet end. I guess people wanted to get out of the heat.
It is hot down here in Las Cruces today, 90-ish.
Yeah, I think 93 right now.
Yep.
So who wants to be outdoors?
I don't know, but I'm not going to complain because I'd rather be hot than cold. That's what I always say.
You're not in any blizzards.
No. So why don't you go ahead and start this story? I think it's going to be a really fascinating discussion. I can't wait to talk to you about it.
Okay, let's go. The murders of Marlene Olive's parents, Naomi and Jim Olive, in Marin County, California, shocked the community, even though many people knew about the severe dysfunction in the household. There had been vicious fighting between mother and daughter for years, and Jim, Father Jim, seemed at a loss on how to improve things. Naomi had such a fear of being committed to a psychiatric facility that she refused the help she needed. And Jim would try to keep the peace, but Marlene became impossible for either of them to control. So let's get a little background on this family.
Okay, Marlene was born in Norfolk, Virginia, in January of 1959. Her mom was 19 years old and unmarried, and her parents arranged for Marlene to be adopted by the Olives. Now, the marriage of James and Naomi Olive started out really well. By the time Marlene was born, they'd been married for 14 years, and they were anxious for a child of their own. Marlene was adopted by the Olives just one day after she was born. Jim would play the role of the doting father, because they were a little bit older, while Naomi had a very dysfunctional approach to motherhood. According to friends, Naomi was an overprotective mom who sanitized anything that Marlene touched and was afraid to leave her side. When they'd get together with other families with kids, Naomi would stay by Marlene's side with the kids instead of joining the adults for dining and conversing.
You mentioned they were an older couple. They'd been married 14 years before they adopted Marlene.
Yes, well, when the murder happened, I think Jim was in his late 50s and Naomi was in her early 50s.
Yeah.
So a little bit older than the other kids' parents.
It is, and I think that's They've been married 14 years, and they were a childless couple that whole time.
Right.
And it seems to me it'd be a little difficult to adapt to a newborn in the household.
Well, sure, but I think it was also one of those cases where the marriage wasn't great, and they thought, you know, if we just had a baby, it would be better. That happened a lot, especially, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. People didn't really, it wasn't as easy to be without children. Now it's an acceptable decision. But everybody was having kids back then, it seems like.
Yeah, they were still older.
Yeah, a little bit.
So the family lived in Ecuador for most of Marlene's childhood. Jim worked there as a marketing executive for Tenneco and Gulf Oil. Marlene was close to her father, and there were many friends that she had there. When Marlene was 14, Jim lost his job, and he moved them back to the United States. And they settled in Marin County, California, in the middle-class Terra Linda community. Now, Marin County is a fairly wealthy place.
Yeah, and they weren't in the upper echelon, but it was a pretty nice area.
Yeah.
It was kind of, you know, working class, middle class.
This move was very traumatic for Marlene. Well, sure, I've moved a teenager. Have you moved a teenager?
Well, yeah, but not to another country.
Right, but just the fact of moving, you're uprooting them, and those early teen years are tough.
Absolutely. But I think it was even worse for her.
It was. You know, she had a lot of friends in Ecuador. She spent 12 of her first 14 years there, and she spoke Spanish better than English. So Marlene cried every day for weeks and weeks. The United States was a pretty scary place for her. She had read about Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and believed that the drug scene in the United States was heavy, particularly in the high schools of California.
And that's not necessarily false. I think there's some truth to that, for sure.
Well, I think if you look at that location, there was a lot of drug
in the 70s?
Usage in the area.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm. But Jim was as anxious as Marlene was about how they were going to adjust to this new community. Their Ecuadorian neighbors threw a big farewell party for them. And Naomi was excited about the move because she thought she was going to live in a more upper-class area and have a better life in the U.S. And I think that was part of her disappointment, as it really didn't turn out that way. When they landed in San Francisco, they stayed at a Holiday Inn while they shopped for houses. They rented a house, and Naomi busied herself buying furniture and decorating. But soon reality sunk in, and she realized that she would be living in what she called reduced circumstances, without the company perks that golf had offered them and the cheap domestic help that Ecuador offered. Naomi would be cooking and cleaning for herself. So it wasn't only an economic shock, but it was also a culture shock for the whole family. But I think Naomi and Marlene just weren't able to adapt.
Well, we know that Naomi certainly wasn't.
No, so she couldn't help her daughter if she can't even do it herself.
Right. I mean, I would always figure that even though the teenager might not like the move, she would adapt more easily than her mother.
Well,
to life in the U.S.
Right. But then it always depends what kind of kids they hook up with.
Sure.
And what's going on at home? Is there a stable base from which to build that?
Well,
which
yeah.
There certainly wasn't here.
Yeah, but all things being equal, I'd have better hopes for Marlene than Naomi.
Yeah, well, Naomi, I didn't have any hope for at all.
Okay. So Jim lost his life savings in a failed business project, but he nevertheless remained optimistic about the future. He did find work with an oil company, but was forced to travel abroad. He liked the travel, but his wife hated it. Naomi began spending more and more time at home and stopped accompanying Jim to social and business events. Then she started to drink every day, then for most of the day. So she'd get up in the morning, start drinking, drink through the day.
And Jim didn't have a good adjustment with his career. He went through a few different jobs before he ended up being self-employed. So things didn't really turn out the way Jim wanted. Jim actually wanted to write books. He wanted to write biographies of famous people and actually worked at it, but it never came true for him. He did get an agent at one point, but he never had anything published.
Yeah.
So life was a disappointment, kind of for Naomi and Jim. So we have this girl growing up with unhappy parents, even though Jim, he tried really hard.
He did. And Naomi sank.
She did. And Jim and Naomi began to sleep in different bedrooms. Soon Naomi rarely left her room. She collected fish tanks and she bought fish to fill them up with. And while she stayed at home talking to her fish and sleeping with her cats, Jim was out working 50 to 60 hours a week. Then he tried to be successful as a self-employed business consultant, and he did have limited success. He supported his family. With Naomi at home, though, Marlene became Jim's regular date to business functions. This was dysfunctional. Jim was working harder than he ever had. He'd wake up at 6 a.m. and spend his days trying to convince small business owners to hire him as a consultant. And a lot of these business owners didn't have much money to spend on that sort of thing. So it was a hard sell. He joined the Terra Linda Rotary Club to meet local businessmen, and he took an accounting course 2 evenings a week. So he was pretty tenacious.
He was trying, wasn't he?
He was.
But his work meant that he wasn't around much for Marlene, as she was trying to adjust to her new life. When they left Ecuador, Marlene was a shy and chubby, rather introverted girl. She'd never been to an unchaperoned party, she'd never smoked pot, she'd never kissed a boy. She certainly didn't fit in with the other girls, who wore tight jeans and halter tops, and Marlene was wearing lace-collared blouses and skirts. So in the first few months of arrival to the United States, Marlene slept a lot, cried a lot, and spent her weekends on the couch watching television.
Yes, so she had to join the 8th grade in the middle of the year. And on her first day in the 8th grade, she couldn't find her classroom. So she sat alone on a schoolyard bench all day, writing in her notebook so she would look busy. Then for the next few months, she would just wander from class to class in a daze, refusing to make eye contact with any of the other students. She began complaining of stomach aches, and she skipped her phys ed class. She kept her bedroom dark and laid on her bed listening to music when she wasn't on the couch watching TV. So it's not going really well from the beginning.
No, it isn't. And you're noticing that neither parent is really doing much to try to push her in the right direction.
Well, Jim's busy.
Jim's busy
and I don't think Naomi's out of it. She doesn't have the tools to do it.
Nope.
She would become an alcoholic shut-in, and she'd often accuse Jim of having affairs. But Jim Olive was the optimist in the family, always seeing the good in everything. He took Marlene for a medical checkup, and she was diagnosed with a duodenal ulcer. She was started on sleeping pills and sedatives, which she began to abuse, and that's how her life of drugs began. Marlene began writing poetry, where loneliness was the prevailing theme, and she was actually quite good. If you look over some of her poems, they're actually kind of sophisticated for someone her age. The unhappier she was in her new environment, the more she idealized her memories of her life in South America. So Marlene felt alone most of the time, as her mother would either suffocate her or completely ignore her, and her father was working all the time to build his business.
And so when Marlene was diagnosed with the ulcer, Jim did try to spend more time with her. He took her with him on some business errands. They would go grocery shopping together. And on weekends, they even went to garage sales together to look for bargains. So whenever Naomi was holed up in her room with a headache, Jim and Marlene would go out for dinner together.
So this is very much like Marlene's taking Naomi's place.
Right.
And kids don't want that. Kids want someone to take control. But Marlene's making the meals, keeping her father company, helping her father with picking out clothes, ironing his clothes. She's become like his little wife.
She certainly was. She was also being paid to address in mail envelopes by her. And this was besides getting a weekly allowance.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So Jim and Marlene did have an affectionate, friendly relationship. But Marlene and Naomi were growing further apart. And Marlene was becoming more of an American teenager, which Naomi did not like at all. So that fall, Jim bought a modest one-story house for them. And Naomi had to give up her dream of a 4-bedroom home with an atrium. She and Marlene had 2 bedrooms across from each other, while Jim had the master bedroom, where Naomi still kept her clothing and her jewelry and things.
But not sleep with him.
Never, no. Naomi relied on Jim to make all of the decisions, too. When she did go out for social occasions, she would sit holding her purse tightly to her chest, clearly nervous, and she wouldn't even accept a cup of coffee without checking in with Jim, letting him make that decision for her. So she's really gone downhill.
Quickly.
Yes. As her interactions with the outside world dwindled, that's when she began talking to herself more and more. Jim and Marlene were familiar with Naomi's imaginary friends, but it got worse in Terra Linda. She'd hold entire conversations with people from her past, like her father and her brother. She'd even get in arguments with Jim's family, who obviously weren't there, playing all the different roles. And she'd play these roles in different voices, with intermittent angry outbursts and crying. Naomi had grown up without her mom, who was committed to a hospital with a mental illness when Naomi was very young. Now, as a result, Naomi was deathly afraid of psychiatrists, and she refused to get help with her own mental illness, which she clearly had and which was clearly getting worse.
Interesting that her mother was mentally ill.
Well, yeah, I think there was a genetic component to that.
Now, the first sign of trouble with Marlene happened in the beginning of the ninth grade. And this is when she and a new girlfriend, were arrested for shoplifting at a local drugstore in the mall. Now, this was apparently a kind of a routine event for this store, and Marlene was released to her father. And according to Marlene, after a brief talking to on the drive home, Jim let the incident slide without punishment.
You know, I think part of it with Jim is he was just exhausted.
Yeah.
A lot for him.
I get this sense from reading about it that he was so consumed with work and trying to make a living for the family that he just didn't have time for anything else.
Well, it's almost like he had two kids at home because they would call him at work while they were arguing and try and get him to take one or the other side, and he's trying to do his work. So he didn't have a partner in Naomi really at all. When Marlene got in trouble for shoplifting, Naomi reacted very differently than Jim. When Jim and Marlene pulled into the driveway, she came out front in her house coat screaming at Marlene so all of the neighbors could hear. And she forbade Marlene from seeing her girlfriend and grounded her for the rest of that weekend. In addition to her prescribed sedatives, Marlene began purchasing pills from some kids at school. Some of these pills came from parents' medicine cabinets or kids who worked in local pharmacies. Chuck Riley, the neighborhood marijuana dealer, also forged prescriptions and got pills from his pot sources. So he was another one of the dealers there.
Her true love. Never mind. So by the end of the ninth grade, Marlene had up to a dozen prescriptions going at any time. And this would include things like Quaaludes and Dexedrine.
So downers and uppers.
Downers and uppers. Eventually, she became loose with her pill use and would take a bunch of random pills at once. This is what the kids would call a rock and roll stew. So not surprisingly, her grade slipped, and she was in danger of failing both algebra and English. Meanwhile, the tense silence between Marlene and Naomi turned into vicious arguments. Marlene often resorted to screaming that Naomi was not her real mother, and Naomi's responses were inappropriate and sometimes brutal.
They were horrible. I mean, she was a horrible mother.
She wasn't Mother of the Year, that's for sure.
That's just not the kind of thing you say to your teenage daughter. I mean, one common response was, your real mother was a whore. And it really just went downhill from there. Naomi was usually drunk, and she'd walk around the house naked, wiggling her hips obscenely, and she'd put her hand on her pubic area, pretending to be Marlene's biological mother, the whore. So I just can't imagine the effect this had on Marlene.
Obviously not a good one.
No, I mean, I think she just didn't want to be at home anymore, and if she was at home, she certainly didn't want to be sober. Marlene began to associate with a group of girls who Jim considered to be beneath her. As she began to get into trouble, he believed that she had just fallen in with the wrong crowd. In reality, these girls were from families of similar means. Marlene's group were known as the hippies. They smoked pot, but they weren't violent. Until the murdering stuff came into the picture, that is. So there were all different kinds of groups in this high school. And well, I guess they weren't the worst.
No, any high school. There's all sorts of cliques.
Sure. The divorce rate in that community was over 50%, which was the norm in the U.S. But this was really disturbing to Jim and Naomi. They had both come from small-town religious backgrounds, and divorce really wasn't even a consideration for them. Very strict Catholics. Marlene first smoked pot when it was offered to her by some girls in her glee club. To avoid seeming too boring to her friends, she began inventing an exciting past for herself. She told people that her real name was Maria Lucia Miranda, and said that her parents owned a ranch which she would inherit someday. She told some girls that she had been engaged when she was in Ecuador, and she showed them a pearl ring of Naomi's that she wore, saying that was her engagement ring.
Marlene's wardrobe also became more extreme and upset both Jim and Naomi. She was regularly shoplifting and would bring home jeans, satiny blouses, and platform shoes. But what really bothered Jim was her thick black eyeliner and mascara. Now, he dealt with it by telling her how pretty she was and she didn't need all that stuff.
And I think that's a reasonable way to try and deal with it.
To try.
I don't think it would make a difference, but...
Yeah, but Naomi's approach was to call her names and shame her. So kind of counterproductive anyway.
Absolutely.
Then arguments between Marlene and Naomi became more bitter as time went on. Now, Jim would try to negotiate truces, but was usually unsuccessful. He wanted Marlene to humor her mother as Naomi's mental illness and alcoholism got worse. Tough to do, though. Fights over simple things like household tasks soon escalated into screaming matches where Naomi called Marlene's biological mother a hooker and Marlene called Naomi a crazy lady. Jim would often come home from work to find Marlene locked in the bathroom and Naomi passed out on her bed.
Well, yeah, by this point, Naomi rarely left her bedroom and she drank all the time. And she was pretty cruel to Marlene. I'm not saying Marlene was an angel, but I think Marlene was put in a bad situation here. She wasn't the child in the family. And many of Jim's acquaintances in Terra Linda never even met Naomi. He often took Marlene along with him, and he called her his other girlfriend, jokingly.
God, I hope so.
After explaining that Naomi didn't feel well enough to come along. So I don't think he meant any harm by that, but that was kind of harmful.
Well, that's just a really... not a great way of putting things.
No.
My other girlfriend. What kind of message does that give to other people and to his daughter?
I know. Well, Marlene told her friends that her parents never slept together. And she would hop into Jim's king-size bed in the master bedroom if she had a nightmare or if she was scared at night, just like she had when she was a little girl. She actually wanted her parents to sleep together and would encourage it. So I think she wanted to get out of that role she was playing. Maybe just, you know, subconsciously. Marlene romanticized her father, but eventually she would begin to resent him for her home situation.
She's in this horrible situation and Dad's not helping.
No.
But anyway.
Well, I think he's thinking the only person he can really talk to in a reasonable way is his daughter. So he's putting her in this situation where she's supposed to humor the mother and be the adult, which she can't be. She's a teenager. So it's very dysfunctional, and we'll talk more about that. But then Marlene met Chuck Riley. She met him one fall day when she was tripping on acid, and he tried to comfort her. He was interested in her from the very beginning. Chuck had never had a girlfriend before. He was the oldest child of Joanne and Oscar Riley. Joanne was a nurse's aide, and Oscar delivered baked goods for Dolly Madison. Chuck had a severe weight problem that began when he was 5 or 6 years old. And by the time he was 10, he weighed close to 200 pounds. Chuck's first job was as a newspaper delivery boy. He kept that job until he was 17, and his boss would remember him as the best salesman and one of the top carriers he'd ever had working for him. With the money he earned, Chuck bought a BB gun. Then he moved on to pellet guns. When he was 13, Oscar agreed to buy him a .22 caliber rifle, but he insisted that he take a gun safety course. Chuck would take the rifle out target shooting at bottles and cans in an undeveloped area of marshland, so it wasn't really a problem, at least not then.
By the sixth grade, Chuck was way beyond chubby. He weighed over 250 pounds, and he had a 48-inch waist. And by high school, he was up to 340 pounds. So he is teased, not just teased, but really ridden. But he took it with a smile. He was given names like Fat Man, Large Charles, and Rocco. He liked Rocco, so that stuck with him.
But I think the big thing to know about Chuck is that he was desperate for people to like him. And that was a thousandfold when it came to Marlene.
Absolutely.
After he began dealing pot in high school, he would give away some to his friends. He began smoking pot at age 16, and by the time he turned 18, he was the leading pot dealer at Terra Linda High. So that was his way to have friends, even though they're not really friends, you know what I mean?
Well, they wouldn't look to him as a friend.
No.
He was a contact.
They wanted something from
right.
him. Right.
He provided a service.
Mm-hmm. And then he began selling cocaine as well. He used that as well as some Dexedrine, and by the time he met Marlene, he was down to under 250 pounds. Still, he was the fat kid, but it wasn't, you know, such a huge thing.
Well, that's 90 pounds or so. That's
yeah,
pretty good.
It's a pretty good weight loss, although the way he did it, I wouldn't recommend.
That's probably not the recommended diet.
but Marlene really had no interest in him at first because he was still pretty chubby.
Yeah, however, Chuck thought that Marlene was the most beautiful girl in the world. He had never asked a girl out before, but he asked Marlene to the drive-in movies. She thanked him for asking, but said she had already had plans with a girlfriend. Now, Chuck wasn't going to give up that easily, so he found a date for Marlene's girlfriend, and they made it a double date. But before he took Marlene out, he had to meet her parents. But he made a good impression. Chuck was a Kirby vacuum salesman, in addition to being a drug dealer, and he tried to sell Jim a vacuum. Nevertheless, Jim was impressed. He saw Chuck as a hard-working, motivated young man.
Well, so, Jim had been a salesman before. He knew what that was like.
Yeah, and Chuck knows how to schmooze, right?
Yeah, right. And the Kirby vacuum was kind of a cover for the drugs, so his parents wouldn't question all the time where he was getting money to buy things.
Right, because at the time, Kirby's were the top-of-the-line vacuum.
Yes, and then when they'd come to our house, my mom would make us hide behind the drapes and not answer the door.
Oh, really? Because she didn't want to deal with the Kirby guy?
No, we weren't much for a salesman coming to the door. Chuck worked really hard, though, over the next several months, trying to make himself more attractive for Marlene. He taught himself some Spanish words and phrases. He bought some books on witchcraft and the occult, too, which was a new interest of Marlene's. He lost another 60 pounds, and he bought himself new clothes. He was still a little plump at about 190 pounds, but that's the thinnest he'd been in years, so
well,
he was feeling pretty good.
He lost the weight of a Chuck, and, right?
Cut his weight in half, really.
Just about. So that's
I'm pretty impressed with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do. But, you know, love will motivate you.
It certainly will. Marlene had a boyfriend, however. Chuck still pined for her. Now, this boyfriend got her into the occult because he told her he was a warlock. Marlene had sex for the first time ever with this warlock, and she adored him. But he dumped her after a couple of months because he said she was too clingy.
You know, this occult warlock thing, you have to look back. This is like the satanic panic era where kids were getting into that, wearing the pentagrams, and adults were really worried about this. Like the devil's taking over our children. That's what was going on at this time.
Well, that plus the drug culture and everything, they all combine to make parents crazy.
They do. And I think back then it was really kind of a connection parents would make. Like, oh, they're smoking that pot and they're going to turn to the devil.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of a thing.
They're going to have sex and get pregnant. And, oh, it's horrible.
It's going to be horrible. But after that breakup, Marlene began to date Chuck Riley. When Marlene agreed to be his girlfriend, he was head over heels in love, and he really couldn't believe how lucky he was. But Marlene was clearly the one in charge in this relationship, and he would do whatever she asked to keep her. And she wasn't above threatening to break up with him if he didn't do just what she wanted. When their relationship became sexual, this was Chuck's first time, but not Marlene's. Marlene had Penthouse and other magazines she showed Chuck, and she had him take nude pictures of her.
Then she started to bring kinkier things into their sex life, whips and handcuffs. And she also wanted to have a threesome with one of Chuck's guy friends, but none of those guys would agree to it. So they instead had a threesome with one of Marlene's girlfriends. Her name was Sharon. Chuck didn't want to have sex with Sharon, but he did it to please Marlene.
And then witchcraft became a bigger part of her fantasy life, too. Marlene told people, including Chuck, that she was a witch. Eventually, Chuck actually came to believe that a bracelet that she gave to him was a way for her to communicate with him. He would call her and she'd say, "Oh, I just sent you a message through the bracelet. I guess you got my message." And he'd say, "Yeah, I guess so." So he was kind of naive for a drug dealer. But I guess he's naive in the ways of love and with girls.
I would say that.
But Marlene did frequently threaten to break up with Chuck if he didn't follow her instructions. And she also had sex with other guys while they were a couple. She claimed to have magical powers over him, and he did seem to believe that sometimes.
Marlene and Chuck went on a shoplifting spree that lasted several weeks. They ended up stealing about $6,000 in merchandise. The items that were stolen were mostly women's clothing and accessories for Marlene. When they were caught, which they were inevitably going to be caught.
Absolutely. I mean, you can only get away with that for so long, and they got bolder and bolder.
Yep.
the way that they ended up doing it, they found was the easiest, was just to pick up things and walk out, just bold as can be. Because if you tried to sneak it out, you were more likely to get caught. But they did eventually get caught.
Yeah, and when they were caught, Chuck was cooperative, and he confessed. He was charged with grand larceny, which was his first adult arrest. A couple months later, he's arrested again, this time for possession of marijuana and a sawed-off shotgun. Those aren't a good combination, drugs and guns.
No.
So Jim and Naomi threaten Marlene with juvie hall. They plan to send her away to boarding school, and they forbid her from seeing Chuck. Jim even got a court order that ordered Chuck to stay away from their house. When Chuck went by the house to talk to Jim, Jim actually threatened to kill him if he ever came back.
Which I think was kind of a shock to Chuck, because Chuck and Jim got along really well.
Yeah, you know, Chuck in his poor little pea brain is thinking, you and I were good buddies.
Yeah, I'll just go talk to him and we'll work it out.
Nope.
No, but Jim was really good at blaming other people for Marlene's actions, and he thought that Chuck was the bad influence. When in a lot of ways it was Marlene that was the bad influence.
That's right.
I think if Marlene had told Chuck, you know, we're going to get good grades, you're going to stop selling drugs, he would have done that.
Sure.
But she pushed him the other direction.
He would have done whatever she wanted him.
Pretty much, yeah. But after they were forbidden from seeing each other, Marlene ran away from home. And she did that a few times. She and Chuck saw each other on the down low. Marlene had talked about killing her mother, but now her anger was extending to her father. She asked Chuck if he knew anyone who would kill her parents. And Chuck just thought she was blowing off steam. He tried to put her off and put her off, actually giving her a fake name of someone that he would ask. But after that didn't pan out, Marlene started wanting Chuck to kill her parents. So we're going down a bad road.
We're not heading down a good path.
No.
Meanwhile, Jim and Naomi are trying to help Marlene. They tried an alternative school for her, and she did well there for a few weeks, but soon began skipping classes and failing. Same pattern. Then they went to family counseling, but couldn't or wouldn't keep up with it, and things quickly went back to the way they were at home.
And the family counselors really recognized that Marlene was in a bad home situation, but I think the parents just didn't want to accept that. And of course, Naomi was resistant to any kind of help. She was scared to death that she was going to be locked up, and I mean, I hesitate to say it a little, but she probably should have been. Probably would have saved her life.
She should have
been.
And
Jim's life. And a lot of people's lives, if you think about it.
So Chuck became estranged from his friends and family. And he ended up spending all his time with Marlene. And not in a good way.
No.
Their sexual relationship had turned sadomasochistic. They used guns, knives, and ropes. And Marlene shocked Chuck more than once when she masturbated with a loaded gun. And she would also tell him to hold a knife to her throat when he was on top of her.
So that is really crazy, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. I found that pretty shocking when I read about that.
And after being forbidden to see each other, Marlene broke up with Chuck. So he was obviously pretty despondent about this. He made 2 suicide attempts with pills. Joanne Riley was worried about her son, and she called to talk to Naomi.
Now, Joanne's trying to be reasonable here and work together as parents.
Yeah, but if she had known who she was talking to.
Yeah, it didn't work at all.
Joanne asked if Marlene and Chuck could see each other on a restricted chaperone basis. She explained how keeping them apart only made them want to see each other more.
And that's totally true.
Totally true. However, Naomi was horrible. In a drunken, slurred rant, Naomi told Joanne that her family lived in a lower income area and the Olives were above them, used to a more luxurious life in South America. She said she couldn't see why Marlene would want to date Chuck when she knew so many boys from better families. So Joanne eventually hung up on her.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, you're not going to win any arguments with her or try to reason with her.
No, she was crazy. But even though Marlene was running Chuck, she'd become really dependent on him for emotional support, so she had a hard time separating from him as well. She had promised not to see him, and she was trying to keep that promise, but she was very unhappy at home, and she began to miss him. Marlene and Naomi had a huge fight as they were preparing dinner together one evening. Naomi had been drinking scotch all day, and she criticized the way that Marlene was slicing the celery. Then she told Marlene she looked like a tramp because she wasn't wearing a bra. Within minutes, Marlene was screaming and biting her arm hard enough to draw blood, her own arm. She'd done this over the years, and she had scars on her arm from biting herself. Marlene called her mother crazy and said that if she wasn't taken away in a straitjacket, Marlene would kill her herself. Then when Jim got home that night, he sided with Naomi, and he banned Marlene from seeing any of her friends.
So when Jim sided with Naomi, obviously Marlene felt betrayed, and she began to complain more and more about both of her parents, and she asked Chuck to kill them both for her. By this time, Naomi was getting worse, and Jim was busier than ever with work. So Marlene began to see Chuck in secret again, and to talk to him on the phone whenever her parents were asleep.
Yeah, they actually put a block on the home phone so Marlene couldn't make any outgoing calls. So Chuck would have to call her from a payphone, and they'd have to talk late at night when the parents were asleep.
She'd have to pick up the phone quick.
Yes, exactly.
So before going on, let's take a quick break for our sponsors.
Okay, let me tell you about Lively Bras. Lively offers bras and undies that blur the aesthetic lines by giving us the best elements of style and functionality from sexy lingerie, activewear, and swim in an entirely new category of intimate wear. Lively is where high style meets ultimate comfort. The fabrics are soft, supportive, and lounge-worthy. Lively has the most comfortable bra you'll ever wear. You can wear it all day, and you might even forget you have it on. Lively sizes range from 32A to 44 triple D, and they charge the same price for all women. No more paying more for a few more inches of fabric. My favorite Lively bra is the Stripe Mesh Bralette. It gives me full coverage and support, but it's incredibly lightweight and it's sexy. It's kind of your all-around everyday bra that works with t-shirts, blouses, or even a little black dress. The website was easy to navigate too, and they have a great measuring guide so you can get the perfect fit that you need from the comfort of your home. I love too that the website is size inclusive with beautiful models of all sizes. For a limited time, get $10 off your first order by visiting wearlively.com/brewery and entering brewery at checkout. That's wearlively.com/brewery, promo code brewery, only available in the U.S. And let's not forget one of my favorite beauty products, Madison Reed. Take coloring your hair at home to the next level with Madison Reed. You deserve gorgeous professional hair color delivered to your door for less than $25. Madison Reed gives you gorgeous, multidimensional, healthy hair with your choice of over 45 multi-tonal shades that have been developed by master colorists who really know how to blend nuances of cool, warm, light, and dark. Many of our listeners have written to tell me how Madison Reed hair color has improved their lives, and I totally get it. Madison Reed delivers gray covering, natural-looking color to my door. Now I'm free from salon visits, and I'm saving a fortune while my hair looks and feels great. So I'm always happy to recommend Madison Reed to our listeners. It's affordable, it's convenient, and it's super high quality. We're busy women. We deserve gorgeous professional hair color delivered to our doors on our schedule for less than $25. And you can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. True Crime Brewery listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with our promo code BREWERY. That's code BREWERY at madison-reed.com.
Back to the program. So one Saturday morning, before Chuck went to the Olive home with a gun, Marlene tried for the first time to poison her mother. Jim was out, Naomi was resting in her bed, and Marlene was across the hall watching cartoons. In the last few weeks, Marlene had asked friends how much LSD or downers they thought it would take to end her mother's life. Then her mother asked for lunch, and Marlene decided she'll give it a try. She made coffee with cream, soup, and a salad with ranch dressing. Then she emptied a dozen or so capsules of Darvon and Dalmains into the food and drink before taking it to Naomi. But a few minutes later, Naomi called out that there was something wrong with the food. It was bitter. Maybe there was something wrong with her taste buds.
So Darvon and Dalmain, what are those drugs? I know Darvon is a painkiller.
Darvon's a pain reliever and Dalmain's a sleeping pill.
So that would be a pretty good combination if she got enough into her.
Yeah, it was way too little. Plus, she didn't take the full dose anyway.
No.
She did drink the coffee, but the only effect that had was to extend her afternoon nap.
Well, you have to remember, she probably had a certain amount of alcohol in her system, too. And If someone drinks a lot, can that build up their tolerance to other drugs? I wasn't sure if drugs would have a lesser effect on you if you drank all the time, because I had read some articles on frequent marijuana users needing more anesthesia for surgery.
Well, I think, yeah, maybe I'll qualify that. It won't have any real effect unless it's trying to occupy the same receptors as alcohol. But the dalmane should have acted just as it would have in a person who wasn't an alcoholic.
But, you know, if you take alcohol and sleeping pills, the combination can be more deadly.
That's not what you did say. You said
right.
It was the opposite.
Right. But that's the case. If I had a bottle of scotch and 12 dalmane, that would be worse than 12 dalmane alone. That's all I'm saying.
Sure.
Yeah.
They both act as sedatives.
Okay.
But nevertheless, she didn't ingest enough of it to do anything.
No, she just slept a little longer that day.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard to say how serious this attempt was. It might have been kind of half-hearted. But the one thing about it that I think is important is that it moved the fantasy of killing her mother from fantasy to reality. Because she's actually acting out things now.
As Marlene's fantasy life blurred into her real life, Chuck was getting more and more confused. He was trapped in her imagination and her desires, but any threat to cut him off terrified him. Marlene began to talk about murdering her parents on a daily basis, and this would become Marlene's obsession.
It was an absolute obsession, and it wasn't only Chuck she talked to it about. She talked to it a lot of people about it.
Yep, she made no secret about it.
No, absolutely not.
So Naomi told Marlene that they're going to send her to juvenile hall for the summer. Marlene turned around and called Chuck and told him that they needed to kill her parents or their relationship was over.
So this day, Chuck had been doing drugs all day, which wasn't really that unusual for him. He went to a friend's house to get a gun. Then he headed to the Olive House with the gun in a paper bag. On Monday, June 16th, Marlene's report card had come in the mail. Jim told Marlene that they decided to send her to boarding school in the fall. Then she called Chuck and told him that she was being sent away. The two met up and she cuddled up to him, asking him again to kill her parents. Afterwards, they would collect the life insurance and get married, she said. Then that Wednesday, 3 days before the murder, Jim and Marlene signed court papers agreeing to conditions of probation for her shoplifting conviction. That night, she told Chuck that her father had put together a list of all of her friends who used drugs, and he was about to turn it into the police, and that Chuck was on that list. So I really see this as her way of kind of pushing Chuck by making him think that her father is turning him in for drug dealing.
Mm-hmm.
So well, it's very tricky.
She's still showing control over him.
Yes, and manipulation and dishonesty.
Mm-hmm. So the next day, Naomi caught Marlene having sex with another guy in the family garage. Now, the garage had been turned into a kind of a den with old living room furniture. And Naomi caught Marlene and some guy going at it. Naomi screamed at her and called her all sorts of names. She promised not to tell Jim, but she went ahead and did, which pissed off Marlene even more.
Yeah, then on Friday, Chuck called to check in on Marlene, and he interrupted an argument between her and her mother. As he was waiting on the line, they continued to scream insults at each other. And when Naomi left the area, Marlene told Chuck, "Get your gun. We've got to kill that bitch today. They're going to put me in the hall all summer." Now, like I said, he'd given his gun to a friend, so he had to go pick it up. But Marlene said if he didn't do it, she'd never speak to him again. So Chuck hitchhiked and walked to his friend's and got the gun. He dropped acid earlier, so he was pretty spaced out, which, like I said, not unusual. He didn't have any bullets for the gun, so he got a ride to Sears to buy bullets.
And Marlene made another attempt to poison her mother by putting Darvon into her mother's lunch again. But her mother rejected the food after a few bites and then promptly fell off to sleep.
But there were several calls between Marlene and Chuck that afternoon. Jim came home at noon and he decided he'd take a short nap too. So while the house was quiet, Marlene took a claw hammer she'd been using to fix a pair of her shoes, and she walked into her father's room at the bedside. She stood over him for a moment and pulled the hammer back over her head, but didn't go through with hitting him. Then Chuck left his friend's house about 1:30 that afternoon. Jim's car was still at the Olive House, and Chuck waited outside behind some bushes. Marlene and her father were going to meet one of her friends to pay back some money that Marlene had stolen. But Chuck watched as Jim drove away with Marlene in the passenger seat. and he'd already been instructed what he was to do.
Chuck would end up giving different stories about what happened that day, and Marlene would change her story multiple times also. So the story eventually believed by a jury was that Chuck went into the house where Marlene had left the claw hammer near the front door. He went to the back bedroom and found Naomi in her bed. Then he beat her multiple times in the head with the hammer. She didn't die right away, so he removed the hammer when it got stuck in her forehead, causing more blood to spatter onto the wall behind the bed. So she's still breathing. Chuck went and got a knife from the kitchen and stabbed her in the chest. Then he suffocated her with a pillow. While Chuck was still in the house, Jim and Marlene returned. Marlene sent her father into the house first, ahead of her. So this is just, I mean, what do you think this guy found? Holy cow.
Awful.
Here's his wife's head bashed in.
There's blood everywhere.
Yeah, she's been stabbed, suffocated, there's blood all over the place. Gray matter from her brains outside.
It was a horror scene. When Jim went to Naomi's room and found her murdered, he picked up the knife and came toward Chuck, according to Chuck, saying, "I'll kill you." And that's when Chuck says that he shot Jim Olive 4 times and killed him. So Marlene came in and saw her murdered parents. She called her mother a real bitch for getting blood on a portrait of Marlene that was hanging in that bedroom. So how cold is that?
Well, it gets worse.
Marlene told Chuck to take her father's wallet and keys from his pockets. He also removed 2 rings from Jim's fingers. Marlene found her mother's purse and took some credit cards. She also took her checkbook, her ID, took off her wedding rings, and her gold watch. This is so cold-hearted. There was a blood-stained hammer laying on the carpet near the head of the bed, and Marlene took it and rinsed it in the kitchen sink and left it sitting with the unwashed dishes.
And there's blood stains, as you can imagine, all over the house, all over the bedroom. Blood on the furniture. Marlene and Chuck made kind of a half-hearted attempt to clean up the scene.
It would take a lot to get rid of everything.
Carpet was hopeless.
Yeah, you'd have to rip up everything.
Right, and they left pink streaks on the wall where they cleaned the blood. So it was obvious that there was some attempt at cleaning things, but a pretty half-hearted attempt.
And I'm not saying this is an excuse for either of them, but I think it's important to remember that they're high as kites, so they're not really thinking clearly either. They are stoned out of their minds.
Right.
Which they usually were.
So in the hours after the killings, Marlene and Chuck tried to forget the horror of the murders. They shut Jim and Naomi's bodies in the bedroom. Then they went to see friends, smoked some pot, went to the movies. Then they decided they were going to have a plan to get rid of the bodies.
Yeah, so this wasn't really thought through.
No, there wasn't any plans other than Marlene telling Chuck, "Kill my parents."
Right, right. So it was dusk when they returned to the house. The telephone was ringing over and over, and they ignored that. And it was primarily Philip Royce, who was Jim's best friend and business partner, making these calls. Royce knew that Jim was going to transfer business records and office equipment to their new office that morning, and he wanted to know how the move had gone. This would be the first of many calls he would make trying to reach Jim before he would contact the police 6 days later. Chuck and Marlene took Jim's car to Chuck's house, where they picked up a gas can. Then they drove to a gas station and bought a gallon of gas. On their drive back to the Olive house, Marlene said they would need to wrap the bodies and load them into the car and take them to a nearby camping area called China Camp.
And so they opened the bedroom door, and there is already a stench in there, despite it only being a few hours since the murders. They protected the carpeting in the car by covering it with a tarp. Then they wrapped Naomi and Jim's bodies in sheets, tied them up with twine, and dragged them into the hatchback of the car. Marlene threw the towels they had used to clean up into the washing machine. Naomi's mattress was stained with blood, and they put it in the car on top of the bodies. The car got stuck when they drove into the woods of China Camp, and Chuck was in a panic as they worked to get it free. He ended up using the mattress and spare tire to get leverage and drove the car out of a muddy rut.
Yeah, but this went on for several minutes, and cars drove by.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the panic.
No kidding.
He's got 2 bodies in his car, a bloody mattress, and the car's stuck in the mud.
Yep, not good.
This is a very sloppy situation, as well as horrid.
So they ended up, after they got the car free, they left the mattress where it was, figuring they'd come back later and set it on fire after disposing of Naomi's and Jim's bodies. So they reached the fire pit in the camp, and Marlene and Chuck moved the bodies and laid them side by side across the pit. Then they piled fallen tree branches around the pit and on top of the bodies until they were waist high. They then tossed the bloody bedding on top, poured gasoline from the can all over it. Then Chuck left a lit cigarette and a matchbook to buy them some time to flee the scene before the blaze went up. So they drove away, but they remained in the area until they saw smoke coming up over the trees.
Yeah, so it was after 4 a.m. when they got back to the Olive House. They set the alarm for 6 a.m. so Chuck could go back to the camp and make sure the bodies had been destroyed by the fire. So Chuck got up, he went to a gas station and refilled his gas can. The camp was still deserted when he arrived, and the fire pit was still smoking. Naomi's body was almost completely burnt, except for some of her larger bones. Jim's body was badly burnt, of course, but his torso and head were intact, and parts of his clothing were still visible. So Chuck added more wood and the gasoline to the fire pit. The fire went up with enough intensity that he was afraid the fire was going to travel to surrounding trees. When he returned to Marlene's house, she had showered and she'd moved some of the living room furniture into her mother's room, trying to make it look like a sewing room. She was on her hands and knees working to clean a large blood stain on the carpet. Marlene wanted to know if Jim had seen Chuck and if he had known that Chuck was his killer. Chuck was pretty sure that he had, because he remembered that Jim had come at him saying, "I'm going to kill you, you bastard." So it's pretty certain that Jim did know who that was, even though Chuck had lost like 60 pounds since he'd last seen him. But by this time, it's after 7 a.m., and Chuck wanted to get home before his parents woke up and realized that he had been out all night. Marlene didn't want to stay at the house alone, so she waited in a parking lot near Chuck's house in her father's car while Chuck went home and showered. Then Marlene walked over, and she ate pancakes with Chuck and his mother, Joanne.
Ho-hum, just another day.
Pretty much, at least for Marlene.
Now, back at China Camp, a fireman found the smoking fire pit, and he was thinking that someone had roasted a deer. Now, Marlene and Chuck returned to the scene that afternoon to add more wood and gasoline, but they left after seeing that someone had shoveled the ashes into the pit. So Chuck asked a biker what had happened, and he was told that someone almost burned the camp down by roasting a deer in the fire pit. So they returned later that afternoon with Naomi's box spring and more wood, which they also burned. So Chuck decided he needed to sleep at home that night so his parents wouldn't become suspicious. And Marlene went to spend the night at her girlfriend Leslie Sloat's house. Marlene told Leslie all about the murder of her parents. Now, Leslie wasn't sure she'd take her seriously, because Marlene seemed pretty keyed up. Now, Marlene told Leslie that it was an unplanned killing. Chuck had done all the dirty work. She said Chuck had threatened to kill her if she told anyone, and he would kill Leslie too if she said anything to anyone.
So Leslie left for work on Monday morning, which I'm just kind of flabbergasted that she didn't go to the police.
Oh, well, I guess I didn't believe what you told me.
Yeah, but I mean, another thing about this is all these friends knew that Marlene and Chuck weren't allowed to be together and that Marlene's parents had grounded her. So don't they find it strange that she's just out and about spending the night at other people's houses and using Jim's car? It's very strange.
One would think.
But nonetheless, Leslie went to work and Marlene couldn't stand being in the house alone for very long. So she called a friend who drove her to pick up another girlfriend, and that's Sharon. That's the one that they'd had the threesome with. When Sharon and Marlene were alone, Sharon asked her if she had killed her parents. And Marlene said yes, she had. Inside the Olive House, Marlene told Sharon the whole story. Now Sharon didn't believe it until she saw Naomi's room. Then Sharon helped Marlene to clean up. They dismantled Naomi's bed frame, put it in the garage, and turned the room into a den or sewing room type of room, not a bedroom, by adding furniture and knickknacks from other rooms. Marlene ran the bloody towels and clothing through the washing machine multiple times. She and Sharon left the house, cashed two forged checks from Naomi's checkbook at a market down the street. Then they stopped at a friend's place to smoke some pot. After that, they went shopping for shoes. Marlene went to a printing shop where she bought an ID that had Naomi's name and information and Marlene's photo. And then she was able to use Naomi's Bank AmeriCard. That evening, the girls returned to the Olive House. Marlene said that she and Chuck were going to wait a year, and then her parents would be declared legally dead. Then they would collect the life insurance and get married and move to South America.
You know, she had told the other girlfriend that it was all Chuck's doing, and she was afraid of him.
There are so many different stories told in this case.
No
kidding. It's really hard to keep it straight.
So that night, Marlene, Sharon, and Chuck slept together in the master bedroom, which was Jim Olive's bed. Chuck had started a new job at a waterbed factory, and he seemed pretty excited about it. The house, however, was becoming a total mess. Marlene and Sharon left shopping bags and boxes all over the living room. There were beer cans on the floor. Unwashed dishes were piling up in the kitchen. Marlene was careful to feed the cats and keep them out of the bedroom, where her parents had been murdered. The cats seemed to go crazy over the smell of blood, and they would meow at the door.
Creepy, huh?
Creepy.
On Tuesday, Jim Olive missed his dentist appointment, of course. Marlene was still answering the home and the home office phone, and they called to reschedule. Phil Royce, Jim's best friend, had been calling, and he talked to Marlene. Since Monday, Jim had failed to show up at his office, and Royce had called him repeatedly. Now, Jim was a precise man who was never late and never absent. Urgent messages were accumulating on Jim's home office phone. So Royce was actually relieved when Marlene answered one of his calls that Wednesday. According to Royce, Marlene sounded really normal and promised to have Jim call him back that evening. She was taking down Jim's messages on a pad of paper beside the phone. She and Chuck went to a Yes concert that evening, high on acid, alcohol, and pot. And by Saturday afternoon, Phil Royce was so worried that he ended up calling the police. After talking to Marlene that Wednesday, he'd called 6 times on Thursday and 8 times on Friday. The home phone was always busy because Marlene had taken it off the hook, and the business phone was just ringing and ringing.
Royce stopped by Jim's house Friday and Saturday. He peeked into the windows and saw that the place was just a total mess. So on Saturday afternoon, he went to the police, and they accompanied him to the Olive House to do a welfare check on Jim and Naomi. The officer felt that a forced entry was justified when no one answered the doors. No car in the garage, but Jim's wallet and ID were on the living room table. Nothing seemed to be missing. Sheets and blankets were stripped off of the master bed, and the nightstand was covered with empty beer cans, marijuana seeds, and a half-empty bottle of tequila. Marlene's room was a total mess, and the floor was covered with pornographic magazines, clothing, and shoes.
So when Marlene came home, Royce and the police officer had gone, but Royce had left a note which read urgent. So Marlene called him back, sounding upset, and asked him where her parents were. She said that she hadn't seen them since she got back from Tahoe on Wednesday. So she's working on an alibi. He tried to console her and offered to let her stay with him and his wife, but she declined that. So Royce called the police and filled them in on his conversation with Marlene. He's getting really concerned and suspicious by now.
Well, he should.
Yes. Marlene was picked up by the police and they questioned her for nearly 14 hours. She gave them several different stories, which had really big contradictions and holes in them. First, she said that her father had killed her mother, and then he had run away. Then she said her mother had killed her father, and she had run away. Another story described a burglar killing both parents, and there was another story that involved the Hell's Angels. One of her stories was that she and her boyfriend had killed her parents, but the police didn't believe that.
Detectives had Marlene admitted to Marin General Hospital and placed on a psychiatric hold. They then returned to the Olive home and found that the walls and carpet had been recently washed. They did find red specks on the carpet, which looked like coagulated blood, and they found pink streaks on the walls in Naomi's bedroom. So Marlene gets discharged from the hospital. Detectives again interrogated her, and Marlene continued to change her story multiple times. When Jim Olive's car was searched, there was a note in the glove compartment with Marlene's Tahoe alibi written out. There were sales receipts in the car and in the house. So when she was shown the sales receipts, Marlene admitted to cashing her parents' checks and using their credit cards. After searching the house, police interviewed neighbors. One woman told them she had heard sounds like firecrackers going off in quick succession about a week earlier.
So that was probably the gunshots.
Probably.
So now Marlene's friend Sharon was picked up and interviewed. And she lied for a few minutes, but then she said she did have something to say, but she wanted a lawyer first. And after being assigned a public defender, Sharon was given immunity from prosecution in return for her cooperation. Sharon took the police to the fire pit where Marlene and Chuck had burned Jim and Naomi Olive's remains. So what do you think of this Sharon? I mean, she knew about the murder. She helped clean up.
She helped with it.
Something wrong with her.
The cover up, yeah.
She's not a normal good person.
Not at all.
And pretty smart, actually, in that she asked for a lawyer. Most young people wouldn't think to do that.
Nope, she got out ahead of things there, didn't she?
She did, and she got away with it all.
Yep.
I mean, she was out spending the dead parents' money. Obviously not too upset or worried about it.
No, she had no concerns.
So when that fire pit was inspected, they did find bones, but none were obviously human. They did find a tooth and a 2-inch vertebrae. The Marin County Coroner's Office was able to identify the bones as human, and gold fillings were found. The calcium deposits on the joints told them that the victims were probably between 45 and 55 years old, and from the thickness of the cranial and limb bones, they were able to determine that there was probably one male and one female victim. So it's probably the Olives, they're thinking, which we know it is.
Yeah, and they thought they had enough evidence to search Chuck's house, and they arrested him. So they picked him up at his waterbed factory. Chuck was described as calm and friendly. So they told Chuck that they'd been to the fire pit, and they then played Sharon's taped interview for him. Now, after listening to that, Chuck broke down in tears, and he confessed. He gave it all up pretty quickly. He said he didn't want to do it, but Marlene made him do it, or she said that she wouldn't love him anymore.
Yeah, but then over time, Marlene's story changed. She said that Chuck had killed her parents on his own, that she hadn't wanted him to, and that he'd threatened her and forced her to take drugs. So she turned on him pretty quickly, even though she'd been writing love letters to him.
Well, it's every person for himself.
But not with Chuck. So based on his confession, Chuck, who was an adult, he was 20, was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder for killing Jim and Naomi Olive, and he faced the death penalty. He had some confusion, though, about whether he killed Naomi or if she had already been struck with the hammer by Marlene when he arrived at the house. So they hypnotized Chuck. Under hypnosis, Chuck said that when he entered the house, he found Naomi Olive lying in bed, and she was bleeding from head wounds and near death, with the hammer embedded in her forehead. So this implied that Marlene had fatally beaten her mother with the hammer before she left the house. But Chuck said that he had stabbed and suffocated Naomi because she was suffering a near death from the hammer attack, and he was trying to end her misery. He said that he at first confessed to killing Naomi in order to protect Marlene. But he admitted to shooting Jim Olive. He said he acted out of fear and self-defense, though, as Jim had threatened to kill him after seeing his wife there covered in blood. The problem with Chuck saying that he killed Jim in self-defense, from my point of view, is that he said he was trapped in the hallway beside a bureau. But there were actually 2 ways he could have exited that house and gotten away from Jim pretty easily. There was a sliding glass door and a back door. This is just a 1-story house. He's not trapped upstairs or anything. At his trial, Chuck testified under hypnosis about the murder and that he had not beaten Naomi with the hammer. But the jury didn't believe him, and they convicted him on both counts of first-degree murder for killing both of the victims. And Chuck was sentenced to death.
Compared to Marlene, though, Chuck didn't seem to have much anger at Naomi. He barely knew her. So his only issue was that Marlene's parents were trying to keep them apart, which would make it less likely for Chuck to use a method of homicide that showed such rage. He probably would have used his loaded gun as the weapon rather than a hammer.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good point, Dick. Why would he kill her with a hammer?
He went there with a gun.
He had a gun.
Although he did say he stabbed her and suffocated her. So by the same token, why didn't he just shoot her then if he was trying to put her out of her misery?
Well, that's another good point. I hadn't thought about that. So we really don't know. but Marlene maintained that Chuck had beaten and killed her mother in addition to shooting her father, and she denied that she herself had any part in the killing of either parent. A psychiatrist who spent a lot of time interviewing Chuck was convinced, though, that Marlene had been the one to kill her mother. According to this doctor, Dr. Spiegel, he gave Chuck opportunities to save himself by saying that Marlene had shot her father, but Chuck stuck to his original story.
He's definitely loyal to his girlfriend.
From what Spiegel learned about the case, he believed that the Olive family was a casebook example of a concept called the parentification of the child. Have you heard of that?
A little bit. I don't know too much. Educate me.
The mother had abdicated her role by telling the child, by her behavior, that she doesn't want to be a mature provider in the family. So the daughter, Marlene's rage, is toward her mother and not her father. The daughter wants her mother to be the life partner and sexual partner for her father, but the mother's refusing to do that. And the daughter wants to be put in her place and be the child, but she's put in this role of partner to her father and parent to her mother. So does that make sense to you with this family?
Yeah.
I think so too.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's pretty dysfunctional.
Super, super dysfunctional. So Marlene was tried as a juvenile. She was charged with violating Section 602 of the California State Welfare and Institutions Code, which covered any crime committed by a juvenile from petty crimes all the way to murder. So she was found to have encouraged, instigated, and acted as an accomplice in the murders of her parents. The judge announced that they would never really know if Chuck killed Naomi or if Marlene did it, but Marlene got 4 to 6 years at the California Youth Authority, and she was released when she was 21. And that's remarkable to me.
It is, isn't it? This guy gets the death sentence.
Yeah.
With, I gotta say, there's just some ambiguity about who actually killed Naomi, right?
I think so, yeah.
And Marlene gets 4 to 6 years.
And it's not like she was 12 or 13. She was 17. So she could have just as easily been tried as an adult and gotten the death penalty as well. So she got really lucky.
She did.
During her confinement, too, she was allowed to serve part of her time outside as a juvenile volunteer. Also, a few weeks before she was released, she escaped and went to New York City, where they found her working as a sex worker. But still, she was released. And after her release, she moved to Los Angeles. She hasn't done well since leaving either. She became a lifelong criminal. She changed her name several times. She was arrested at least 7 times over the next 10 years. For forgery, writing bad checks, and multiple drug offenses. In 1986, she and 14 other people were arrested in L.A. for running a counterfeiting and forgery ring. Marlene was sentenced to 5 years in prison. She had 2 or more convictions in the 1990s, too, and was arrested again in 2003 for forgery, theft, and possession of counterfeit checks. So I feel like she probably should have gotten more punishment.
Well, you're kind of saying that with the benefit of hindsight.
Yes, I am. I know. But, I mean, I really, is there much doubt in your mind that she was the instigator of this murder? They even said so when they sentenced her.
No, I think she did. And I think she was lucky to get the light sentence she did.
And I think a lot of it's related to the fact that she was a young girl. I think if she was a male, she wouldn't have gotten that.
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Chuck's death sentence at San Quentin prison was commuted to life imprisonment, and he ended up being sent to a lower security prison. While in prison, he earned a bachelor's science degree in business administration. His prison work reports were mostly above average to exceptional. He had completed vocational drafting with A-plus grades. His instructor stated he was employable in that field, and he had also completed training as a milling machine operator, a tool grinder operator, and a lathe operator. He stopped using all hard drugs, but continued to use marijuana while incarcerated until the mid-1980s. He has not used any mind-altering substances since the 1980s, and states he would never again use drugs. He has participated in 12-step programs at various times throughout his imprisonment, and has been an active member of Narcotics Anonymous from 2008 on.
Yeah, he also married twice while in prison. When he was 29, he married a woman he met through correspondence, but they divorced after just a year. Then when he was 31, he married a woman who he stayed married to for 10 years, when she died of breast cancer. In 2012, Chuck had been denied parole a total of 14 times. In 2014, the parole board ordered that Chuck Riley be placed in a transitional housing situation, directed that he participate in a specified parole program, abstain from alcohol and any controlled substances, and that he be subject to drug testing. But then in 2015, the governor reversed the board's decision to grant parole, saying, "Until he is able to come to terms with his role in this horrendous double murder, he will be unable to avoid violent behavior if he is released." The governor's explanation for reversing the grant of parole really focused on Chuck's statement to the board that the murders were an impulsive act carried out after plans that were only made that same day. From this statement, as well as language in the 1978 Court of Appeal opinion, affirming that Marlene and Chuck had prearranged the crimes, the governor reasoned that Chuck refused to acknowledge his actions were not impulsive and that they were actually calculated and entirely without empathy, and that he continued to paint himself as a bystander caught in the grip of romantic infatuation, and that's why he shouldn't be released. So what do you think about Chuck? Should he have been let out of prison?
Well, I kind of agree with the governor.
Do you?
Yeah. Yes, he's been a model prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done quite well for himself, considering where he is.
And maybe he's better off just being there.
Maybe
he's one of these people who does better in a situation like that, where everything's controlled for you.
That could be.
But I really feel like Marlene is at least as guilty as he is. So to me, that makes it unfair. Not necessarily that he should be free, not necessarily that she should have gotten the death penalty, but absolutely, I see a big discrepancy here that doesn't seem fair.
You're right.
So this case is often referred to as the barbecue murders, which I really don't like, because it really doesn't give any indication of what really happened in these murders, other than where the bodies were disposed. There's actually not a real ton of media on this case, but I definitely recommend a book that we read that's titled Bad Blood by Richard M. Levine. Unfortunately, it's not available digitally, so if you want to read it, you have to find a hard copy. But what a fascinating case. So much psychology here.
There's a lot of stuff, that's for sure.
I mean, how do you feel about Marlene's life? Do you feel like if she wasn't in that home situation, she may have turned out differently?
I think so.
Sometimes I think that, but then I think the way she's been ever since makes me feel like maybe she was just born bad.
Or maybe she was damaged enough with her upbringing that she stayed bad.
Yeah, that's true too. But it's definitely sad. I feel the most sadness, really, for Jim Olive. Even though he probably should have done things differently, I think he was trying to do the right thing for his wife and his daughter. He just didn't do the right things all the time.
Yeah, I get the impression that he tried, but he had limited ways of going about it.
Well, we all do. I mean, if you look back at your life, don't you see situations where you could have done things differently?
Well, of course.
And I think that's all there is to it with him as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except I don't have a daughter who's a murderer.
Well, no. But then also you have to take into account that she was adopted and there could be genetic things going on as well.
Well, there could be. There certainly was genetic things going on with Naomi.
Oh, absolutely. I really believe that.
Yeah.
I really believe at the heart of this problem was Naomi's mental illness and not getting help. And, you know, I think it's better now, but I think in the 70s, there was a resistance to getting help. Of course, there's a stigma attached to mental illness, which I hope is getting less, but I think that was a big problem here, is that even Jim didn't want to admit that his wife was mentally ill. How would it make them look?
Sure.
I think that was something that one of Marlene's counselors even mentioned at one point, is the parents seem more worried about how things looked. And a lot of families are guilty of that. That's not really that unusual.
No, it isn't.
No. Well, thanks for the discussion, Dick. And a big thank you to Tristan Capel for writing and producing our music. A quick reminder to everyone about Team Tie Grabber. Team Tie Grabber is a way for you to give support to the podcast and get yourself an extra episode each month. As soon as you join, you get an email with login information and a link, and you can add our members-only show to your podcast app. Then you have access as well to all of our past members-only episodes, in addition to a new one that we record every month. Last month, our episode was the story of Laurencia Bembenek. In June, we're covering the story of Christopher Porco. Tell us a little bit about Christopher Porco. I think a lot of people have heard of this case.
It's fairly well known. This was an attack that occurred in the middle of the night. Porco's father was murdered, and his mother was left for dead after a brutal axe attack on both of them. Before the mother was rushed to the hospital, police say she told them that her son was the perpetrator, even though he was attending college 3 hours away. She went to the hospital and actually survived, and she's recovering from the attack, but she woke up with no memory of the attack. And she now believes that her son, Christopher, was innocent of the crime. But investigators were sure Christopher was the one who did it. And we'll talk about it. I think there's pretty convincing evidence that he did do it.
Yeah, very strong circumstantial case, if nothing else.
Right.
And who can blame his mother? I can't. I mean, all that that woman's been through. Why would she want to believe that her son had done that?
Well, and it's, in a sense, it's nice that she doesn't have memory of that.
Oh, for sure.
Because
yeah,
then
you're right.
If she could remember the whole thing.
Can you imagine?
Then what?
Well, that'll be a good discussion. We'll be doing that within the next week or so, right?
We should be, yeah.
Okay. So one more thing. If you have a few minutes to spare, we really appreciate if you could leave us a review. You can do that on iTunes or wherever you listen. Now, we're moving into feedback, and if you'd like your voicemail played on a future show, just go to tygrabber.com, where you can click on Leave a Voicemail. And using your computer or your smartphone's microphone, you can just talk into it, and it will be recorded, and we'll listen to it. We'd love to hear your comments on cases we've covered or suggestions for cases you think we should cover. We do get voicemails that are just wonderful compliments to us, which we, of course, enjoy listening to and we appreciate. We don't play those on the show because we don't feel like that everyone would want to listen to that. Plus, we don't really like to blow our own horn that much. It's very uncomfortable. But I do want to thank people that have left those as well. They are appreciated.
Well, they certainly are. But as you said, we don't want everybody to keep hearing platitudes about us.
No, nobody wants that.
Nah.
Alternatively, you can send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com or just throw us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Another thing you can do is join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions page on Facebook, where you can chat with us and other listeners about past cases, case suggestions, or current news in the true crime genre. I think Dick actually gets a fair amount of feedback from that as well, don't you?
I do.
Okay, let's do feedback.
Okay, we have a couple voicemails. The first one's from Mimi, and she has comment and a case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Mimi from San Francisco, and I wanted to let you both know how much I enjoy your podcast. I love the chemistry the two of you have together. I just finished watching Dear Zachary because of your latest podcast. I feel so much hurt for the Bigsbys, and I admire them so much. I don't know if I'd have the same strength that they have. I don't know how they were so strong. You guys told that story so well. Also, I have a question and was wondering if your podcast about the flight attendant Hella, who was killed by her pilot husband, was done based on my suggestion. I had emailed you about it over a year ago, and I was just curious because that'd be really cool if you did one based on my suggestion. And I wanted to give you one suggestion of a possible case you can cover, and it's the murder of Jennifer Jenkins, and the main suspect is her brother. There's so much to the story. There's actually a documentary about it called Life with Murder, and I think you guys should check it out, and I think you guys might be able to tell that story very well. Okay, thank you for your time. Have a good day.
Thanks, Mimi.
Yeah, so first of all, we did the wood chipper murder case based on the suggestion, and I don't recall who it was. I'm sorry, Mimi. It was probably you.
It probably was.
Because I don't think we got a lot of them for that case.
No, we've been terrible about that, and we're gonna change that, right? We're gonna remember the first person who suggests something.
I'm gonna write down. I am writing down.
Okay.
I took over from the old person who's doing it.
Yes, who was doing kind of a piss poor job.
Or whoever that was, I think it was one of the dogs.
Well, they can get kind of lazy sometimes.
They can.
Yeah.
The case suggestion is an interesting one. The brother was convicted of killing his sister, and his parents for years stood by him and said he wasn't the perpetrator until he actually confessed.
Wow.
That he had done it.
Those poor parents.
So, interesting story. I think it'd be worth looking into.
Absolutely. So we'll watch that documentary.
Yep.
Okay. Another thing I just wanted to add is, I really agree with her on the Bagby's, incredible people. Just the fact that they were able to do all of that for their grandson. Remarkable to me.
Totally.
And totally heartbreaking that they lost him after losing their son. So, yeah, one of the saddest cases that we've ever done, I believe.
Oh.
Well, it's hard to say.
It was for me.
But it was hard to read about, hard to watch about. Yeah. Okay, so who's next?
We have another voicemail from Bobby, and he has a case suggestion.
Hey, Dick and Jill. First, I wanted to tell you guys how much I like your podcast. I listen to it almost every day when I'm at work, and even started drinking beer here and there again since I started hearing Dick give his beer reviews. You guys are funny, too. Anyway, I messaged you guys this on Facebook before, but I figured I'd do it properly. I have a case suggestion. I heard about it in the book by John Douglas, Mindhunter, the one that show on Netflix was based on. It's about the murder and kidnapping of a girl named Sherry Smith. When I heard the story, it's fucked up to say, but it reminded me of a movie almost, the way it played out. This Sherry girl is snatched right out of her driveway while she's getting her mail, and her killer, a pudgy redneck named Larry Jean Bell, called her parents and harassed them, then made Sherry write a last will and testament and sent that to them. The FBI profiler John Douglas said it was one of the saddest cases he's ever worked. Later, he killed Sherry and called her parents, telling them where to find her. After that, he kidnapped and murdered a 9-year-old and told them where to find her, too. They eventually caught him, and he died in the electric chair. There's a Forensic Files episode where they talk about how they caught him, and an FBI Files episode on YouTube, too. You can hear the killer's calls to the family and his 911 calls, and the book Mindhunter probably covered it better than anybody else. Anyway, keep doing what you guys are doing. It keeps me sane at work. Thank you.
Thank you, Bobby.
He thinks we're funny.
Yeah, that's nice. You like that more than anything, don't you?
I think we're kind of funny on occasion.
Yeah.
This is a pretty good case.
Yes, I own that book, but I haven't read it. I did watch the Netflix series.
Yeah, we have the book in our bookcase.
We do. You've read it.
There's a whole chapter. And I'm familiar with this because this occurred while I was living in South Carolina. It was in Columbia, South Carolina. This guy, Larry Jean Bell, is a real piece of work.
That just sounds awful.
It was awful.
Yeah.
I'm writing it down. We're going to look into that.
Okay, I think that would be a good one to cover. I think I may have seen the Forensic Files. It does sound familiar.
Right.
So, but yeah, thank you so much for leaving a voicemail. We rarely get one from a boy,
A boy type?
Yeah.
But it was good.
It was good. Very good voicemails.
He went through the proper channels, he said.
That's right. Okay.
All right, couple emails.
Let's do those. So this is a comment on the Hendricks case from Sam. And Sam writes, I'm really loving your podcast. I've been pretty much binge listening at work every day since I found it. I just finished listening to the Lorraine Hendricks case and want to share an experience I had. And that was about a policeman who pulled a woman over and raped and killed her. So Sam writes, I was moving to Ohio from California in 2017 and was driving through Missouri pretty late at night. I was tired and by myself, and I just wanted to get to the next state before stopping to sleep. I got pulled over, and the police officer was very kind and professional, but he did ask me to step out of the car. It was pretty cold, which is why I assumed he asked me to sit in the front seat of the patrol car while he wrote me a warning, but it turns out he was vetting me to determine if I may be trafficking drugs over state lines. Young girl traveling alone in a giant rental SUV with basically all of her belongings in the back. He did ask to do a search of the car where he basically just opened doors and looked in. And speeding towards state lines. Really a wrong place, wrong time situation. Maybe depending on what officers suspect, they may have you step out of the vehicle. I've never had it happen except for that time. I will definitely never speed in Missouri again though. So, yeah, I can relate as a woman. I wouldn't want to do that. That would make me nervous.
I mean, it was a creepy enough story.
Yeah. Although, you know, 99.9% of the time, it's a policeman doing his job.
That's right.
But especially after the story of Lorraine Hendricks, yeah, it's scary.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much for sharing your story, Sam.
Then we have one final case from Heather. This is about Hannah Hill. Hannah left her parents' home in Kenmore which is in Akron, Ohio, in May 1999. She was 18 years old and was due to begin a new job the following morning. On her way home, she stopped off at a friend's apartment. His name is Denny Ross. She didn't arrive for work the following day, and her new employer contacted her parents, and they filed a missing persons report. She'd been so excited about her new job that she would have missed her first day there. 6 days later, her body was found stuffed into the trunk of her car. She had been strangled. Her gold Geo Prism had been parked on Kane Road in Ellet, which is about a mile from Denny's apartment. So, of course, he's questioned by police, and he insisted that they only kissed and stuff, and she left the apartment afterwards. 2 days later, he's indicted and charged with murder. So his trial that began in 2000, the prosecution's case was that he had a history of battering and strangling women during sex while they were intoxicated. They had very little physical evidence. No blood or DNA found in his apartment. There's nothing that linked him to Hannah's car. So this case was declared a mistrial due to the alleged misconduct of one juror. Despite that, they had unanimously found Denny not guilty of all charges. So years of appeals and legal arguments followed. Denny challenged the propriety of a retrial in both state and federal court, with the focus being double jeopardy. So the Ohio Supreme Court ruled in 2010 that the prosecution could no longer seek the death penalty, but he could face a retrial, which they did.
Okay.
So this began in 2013. The prosecution thought they had a stronger case, thanks mostly to advances in DNA testing. So they said that DNA evidence on Hannah's clothing, fingernails, and in the trunk of her car all linked Denny to the crime. The official cause of death was asphyxia by manual compression. Police also said they found a bag of Hannah's clothes outside Denny's apartment below the second floor window that they believed he allegedly threw there while they were on their way up to search the apartment. Furthermore, in 2004, while out on bond in relation to Hannah's case, he was convicted of the rape of a woman in Akron, and he was sentenced to 25 years for that crime. Now, he didn't face any rape charges in relation to Hannah's case in that retrial, and the jury did find him guilty of murder, felonious assault, and tampering with evidence and abuse of a corpse. He was sentenced to life in prison, eligible for parole after 19 years. After his conviction, he sought an order for discovery. His father had noticed a woman on a site dedicated to remembering Hannah, one of the friends on the site believed was a juror in the case. So Denny wanted to find out when she joined the website. If it was before the verdict, he believed that would mean she was not impartial. Now, he was denied discovery on the grounds that his father only saw the site after the guilty verdict was reached, and therefore the juror would have been discharged of her duties in that case. So it's kind of confusing.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing is questioning, well, I shouldn't be charged again or tried again. Yeah.
But this sounds familiar. I've heard of this case before.
Good case.
It's an interesting one, yeah. One that we might want to find out more about.
Okay.
Well, thank you to everyone for your feedback, whether voicemail or email. We really appreciate it.
We do. So thank you.
Yep.
So keep them coming.
So we'll be back soon with our members only episode, and we'll see you next week with a regular episode of True Crime Brewery.
We will.
We'll see you at the quiet end.
Oh, we'll save a place for you. We still got some of that Pugachev.
All right, we'll save some.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.